Before listening to this lesson, stop your cassette and turn on your radio. Listen for 15 minutes to both the AM and FM stations, which are most popular among your young people.
Many years ago, a group called The Loving Spoonful recorded the song, Do You Believe in Magic? This described the almost eerie appeal of rock music to the young. It really is a Pied Piper phenomenon that has power to change moods and alter emotions, to cast an almost religious spell over kids. The charm of music has always been known, but the power of rock is a new phenomenon.
Moody Blues are about the most depressing group that you'll
hear. Yeah, they are depressing just because they're pessimistic.
Also, like, the mood of the music itself is depressing. I mean, it's really mellow. You know?
But, like, I don't know, I think, like, they have, like right here, it gets, like, happy, you know? And it just sort of seems like they're saying, like, you can be pessimistic about the future because so many things are going wrong, but yet there's still hope, you know? If you can have love, then, that's just what they say to me, I don't know.
As ministers to youth, we are interested in rock for a number of reasons. For one thing, it's such an integral part of kids' lives. There's an availability of media, the transistor, the cassette recorder. They shall have music wherever they go. For most kids, music is a passive pastime. They are in it to some extent by dancing, but not necessarily. Just listening, feeling, is enough.
Rock music should be listened to different than normal music. To really listen to good rock, you have to, like, surrender yourself to it and allow it to take you where it will. And if you're not willing to do that, like, you can't retain your identity and have a conversation at the dinner table and listen to this music. It's not made to do that with. You have to let it sort of invade your soul and get you from within and like turn you around and do what it will with you. And when you can surrender and sort of allow it to become with you, one, then you can enjoy it, really get into it.
For a large number, rock is a participatory pastime. There is active involvement. There are more great musicians in our streets than ever. In the early 50s and in the 60s, kids were four-chord wonders on their cheap guitars. They could play a C, an A minor, an F, and a G, and do almost any song on the charts. But today, the kid owns a $300 Gibson guitar, and he plays jazz riffs like the pros. We are also interested in rock because it is a part of youth culture, and here too, in both active and passive ways. Rock music shapes youth culture by describing phenomena in the culture, by affirming it, and by encouraging it. The most obvious example is the whole drug phenomenon. When Grace Slick and the Jefferson Airplane sang the song White Rabbit, they were affirming its goodness and its acceptability in the culture. And they were encouraging it. They ended the song by screaming, "Feed your head, feed your head." A second example, one that is perhaps more common and more recent, is the affirmation of the simple life, the life out there in the country, by so many of today's young singers.
Blow up your TV,
throw away your paper,
go to the country, build you a home,
plant a little garden,
eat a lot of peaches,
try
and find Jesus on your own.
In a passive way, rock music is also fed by the culture that it influences. The giants of rock are not a musical elite. They are people's poets. They are the people. A guy with a guitar can make the charts. And it's not like the 40s, when you needed a 20-man band or even the 50s with the electric combo. The Taylor family, for example, James and Kate and Livingston, are just plain common filthy rich kids with no training in music, but a great feeling for life and beauty and the harmony of the spheres.
Hey mister, that's me up on the jukebox. I'm the one that's singing this sad song. Well, I'll cry every time that you slip in one more dime, and let the boy sing the sad one more time.
There are few superstars in rock now. A beautiful person will get a great hit, splash, make a few hundred thousand, and retire to his private isle for eternity. We don't expect many more Sinatras or Dean Martins. And so rock isn't telling kids what they should believe. It's telling them what they do believe. And in the process, it's telling us, as shepherds to that flock, what kids believe also. It's an excellent barometer of where kids are.
Music is a frighteningly large force in youth culture today. I mean, a lot of attitudes are influenced by it. And so it would be helpful to understand music if you want to understand youth.
Another reason for us as pastors to be paying attention to rock music. It's a contact point with the kids. And I guess this is a tricky point because it gets dangerously close to hypocritical hipness. We use rock to establish a phony rapport with kids in order to slip them the truth. This really isn't what I'm talking about. Most of the churchly use of rock music falls flat because it does not understand rock as a medium, and church folk can't honestly express their faith in a foreign tongue. But rock is a wide field. There's room for everyone, even a minister or two.
There's so many divisions of it. I mean, like, there's just the foot-stomping hard rock that most people call, like, some groups like Humble Pie or Grand Funk play. Mm-hmm. And that's really going out of style because, you know, it's just they play the same old chords on the guitar and the same drum roll. Mm-hmm. It's not really, you know, very meaningful. And then there's, you know, albums that come out that, like, are political albums or have something meaningful to say. And, you know, you can't really classify them together. And then there's, you know, there's just music that's really good to just listen to. And that just falls in another category. And, you know, like, it's really hard, you know, for a parent to say, well, you know, this is rock music, and say something like Jefferson Starship, which is, you know, a really important album, at least to me.
Tell us about the Moody Blues and what they're trying to do.
Well, first of all, they have a really neat technique, I think. Like, they combine, I don't know, rock or whatever, you know, whatever, with classical type thing. Like, a lot of their records have big orchestras in the back, and between verses they have really, you know, almost like classical type music. I think that's really cool because I like both of them, and you get them at the same time. And they sort of express, you know, their main theme, it seems to me, is that they're worried about the future. And it looks like things might not be so good in the future, but it seems that, you know, if you have the basic elements like love, that you ought to be able to do something about it. And that's the way I feel. So it's, you know, and also it just makes, like, a lot of times I just play it when and not really listen to the words, but the music is really fabulous.
What do you mean to say bubblegum group?
they associate with the AM stations, you know, the teeny boppers, you know, bopper music and things like that. I don't know.
The
Parkinson. Yeah. Yeah. Or Donny Osmond or something like that. Yeah, I mean, they've just sort of been associated with it. Most people think of the teeny bopper music as just, you know, music that doesn't say much. It's just usually love music or something, you know. And it's got some sort of neat beat to it or something, but it's really not much of anything. And it's just sort of surprising to see how these two groups have been classified in there.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of the music that's like, you know, like the Partridge Family and those kind of groups, they all sing like songs about love and, you know, how somebody's heart is broken and everything. And like a lot of these groups are, you know, people, they sort of express that same thing, but there's always something deeper, it seems like, you know, or maybe they'll have like one song like that, but then maybe two or three other songs that, you really have to analyze. It seems like a lot of kids are to the stage now that they want something to think about, you know, rather than, like, you know, just be told, like, oh, no, my heart was broken, you know. They really want something that, you know, really...
more sophisticated.
Yeah, it's, like, more sophisticated and really something that's thought-provoking.
Now that I've lost everything to you, you say you want to start something new, and it's breaking my heart, you're leaving. Maybe I'm grieving, but if you want to leave, take good care. Hope you have a lot of nice things to wear. Then a lot of nice things turn bad out there. Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. It's hard to get by just upon a smile. Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. I'll always remember you like a child girl. You know I've seen a lot of what the world can do, and it's breaking my heart in two, because I never want to see you
what's
die, girl.
Don't be a song like this, which is, I guess, written by Cass Stevenson, obviously, and a song like, say, Johnny Allison would sing. When you say sophisticated love song, what do you mean?
Well, okay, like, something like Donny Osmond, he's, like, talking maybe about two people, a girl and a boy, and something happened, or, you know, or they fell in love. But something like that, it says that, but it also, you can apply it to, like, all of mankind, and it's talking about the whole world. And so it's like, you know, that's how poetry is a lot of times. Like, you read it, and it means something superficially, but you can look deeper and apply it to so many things. And that's, like, what that
is. We haven't heard any kind of hard rock.
Yes.
Hard Rock went out.
Hard Rock?
Yeah.
And it's like two of the best groups that I've really ever heard, now people consider them the bubblegum groups, and that's Steppenwolf and Three Dog Night.
Feeling all right. I'm feeling so good myself. Feeling all right. I'm feeling so good myself.
As the pastor to kids, you have a distinct advantage over mom and dad, who can't stand the sounds that come from their sons' or daughters' bedrooms, and who spend their time trying to convince the kids that Lester Lannan has soul. But if you can honestly come to an appreciation of one or a few aspects of the rock scene, you've reached some kind of a touch point with kids, whose music is entwined with their lives.
And another thing that I find is really, well, when my father listens, like, to classical, I think he does it, you know, I think he really surrenders himself to it a lot of times. But the funny thing about it is he always tells us, you know, your record is too loud. When he plays the record downstairs, I can hear it on the third floor. I mean, you can't talk down there. You have to yell because he has it on so loud. And I'm always tempted to just break his mood and ask him, could you please turn the record down? It's too loud. I don't like this noise, you know.
But that's music. That's
but it's really strange, you know?
It has a lot to do with not being open-minded, because, like, I know for myself, that, you know, after 3 or 4 or 5 years, I don't know how long I've been listening to the music that I listen to, it gets to a point where I don't really want to hear somebody else's music, you know? And so, like, they've been listening to their type of music for, you know, 40, 50 years, and they just really don't want to hear somebody else's, you know? And that really has a lot to do with it. Because I've seen that some parents who have actually sat down, you know, listened to the music the appropriate way and everything and sort of gotten into it, actually do like it a lot better than their own. But it's a matter of getting them to sit down and take the time.
A few notes on how to listen to rock music. The beat, the music, and the lyrics in rock are not to be separated. It's a total aesthetic package. Mom and Dad miss the point when they complain, I can't understand the words. Well, rock is not meant to be understood, but experienced. A rock musician will ask, are you into James Taylor or Chicago or The Who? And that has a parallel with the Old Testament verb yada, to know. not to cognitively understand, but to enter into a relationship with. As there is a sexual dimension with yada, also there is with the word into, but that's almost incidental.
You have to let it sort of invade your soul and get you from within and like churn you around and do what it will with you.
Rock demands a personal experience with the music if it's really going to have any meaning at all. And in a sense, that demands commitment from us. Commitment to rock as part of our ministry to youth, but more than that, simply because it's a meaningful and joyful expression of life.
The prodigal son, he'd been away a while. He was working his way back home now, over many a ragged mile.
One cannot help but encounter religious themes in rock music. Often it is difficult to fully understand what the composer and the artist mean to convey. Maybe they don't really know themselves. We'll listen to several selections which make use of religious symbols and the subsequent reflections of our group.
People trying to be free. Now we got to make the faces. This time around, gospel changes, Lord, still going down. Jesus, he did not doubt his gift, though he knew that he had not long to live. He took care of the business, teaching us how to fly. Then he bowed his head, laid down to die. I listened to what the good book said, and it made good sense to me. Talking about reaping what you're sowing, and people trying to be free.
To me, it sounds like a cycle of life which repeats itself over and over again. You said something about the prodigal son coming back or something like that. And I didn't catch it like in the logic, the prodigal son's story. I didn't catch it where the son is coming back, but I caught it as though in another generation the prodigal son is coming back.
The difference between when someone, like my parents maybe read the Bible when they were my age, how because of the time, they would take something seriously and other things they would kind of ignore and say it's out of place. And now, hopefully, you know, you can take it more in stride with the time. I mean, they haven't been here, but it's like the gospel will change along with the people and how they're changing along with it. And if you can't relate the gospel to the way the people are, I don't think you can really say it's, for a universal understanding if you can't relate it to the contemporary time.
I guess how I've interpreted it every time I've heard it was that he says he's read the Bible and he, you know, agrees with most of the messages. But for him, the names and the faces, he sort of changes to fit things he knows. Like, you know, his life. He doesn't think Abraham, long flowing beard, you know, all this stuff. He probably, I don't know, fits it somehow to his own lifestyle and people he knows. Which is sort of what I do.
Sunday morning, very bright, I read your book by colored light that came in through the pretty window picture.
All these Jews are talking about God, trying to make me think about for a
I visited some houses where they said that you were living, and they talked a lot about you, and they spoke about your giving. They passed a basket with some envelopes. I just had time to write a note, and all it said was I believe.
It seems all his references are to church make it sound like it's all fake ceremonial type thing.
Yeah, like
it's reciting poetry and passing the basket and that kind of stuff.
The one line that said, even that the man said God was dead, but the church, but the house will go on living.
Mm-hmm.
implying that, you know, disregarding God, there it is.
A relatively new genre of rock music came on the scene in the fall of 1970 with the recording of Jesus Christ Superstar. Since that time, other religious musicals have been produced, but none have had the impact of the original production. One of the brighter followers of Superstar was the rock opera Godspell, produced in 1971 in New York City. Its songs, based on the Gospel of St. Matthew, are catchy and easily singable. In fact, it would not be very difficult to imagine some of the songs from this musical sung in the context of a worship service. Notes on the use of rock music in our youth ministry. How about to begin a counseling relationship? Sometimes it's helpful if a kid knows that you know some rock music for this to provide a touchstone to begin conversation about a problem he might be having. Perhaps this has happened to you already in your youth ministry. Or for Bible class as a teaching aid. As long as it's not forced, then it might be all right. Songs, remember, are not meant to be analyzed, but to be experienced together. And the discussion that evolves out of that experience is often very helpful for a group. Or homiletically, references to rock music in sermons may leave parents cold, but the kids in your congregation are part of your homiletical audience too. Or liturgically, for worship. Have you thought of using rock music right off of the charts in your worship service? Much of what the church considers, quote, approved youth music is often musically pallid and simplistic. It might be good to consider baptizing rock music and using it in some of the worship services of the church. Let's close this section with a few words from Scripture, from the book of Acts, the 17th chapter, beginning with the 22nd verse. Paul stood up in front of the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked through your city and looked at the places where you worship, I found also an altar on which it is written, 'To an unknown God.' That which you worship then, even though you do not know it, is what I proclaim to you." Christian phrases that we find in rock music, the religious ideas, the concepts of salvation, the saviors and the gods, which are also in rock music, may not be our idea of the God who is revealed to us in Scripture through His Son Jesus Christ. But before we scrap the gods we find in rock, let's take a cue from St. Paul, whose ministry indicates that if it were necessary to rock in order to reach the rockers, he'd be hard into it. And would probably enjoy it too.
Celebrate, celebrate, dance to the music. 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 Celebrate, celebrate.
This concludes this lesson. Run your cassette forward until it stops and begin the opposite side for the next lesson.
About the war between the generations. Most people euphemistically call this a generation gap. I think that's very misleading because it implies that it's something that is eventually going to be closed or bridged over or something like that. It makes much more sense to talk about it as a war because it's a life and death issue. There is absolutely a struggle going on where somebody has to win and somebody else has to lose. Now, if you think of it as a war between generations that exists inside the youngster himself, and one generation that is alive inside any adolescent is the child part of himself, which has grown up under his parents' protection and which has to be defeated by the adult part of himself, which is emerging and is going to have to take responsibility for living out in a world without parental protection. And it is a vicious war. It is, as one writer says, all the more bitter because it's a civil war going on inside the kid. Parents are simply seen as unwitting allies of the child part of oneself that has to be defeated, and they have to be defeated if you're going to defeat the child part of yourself. For example, when you're getting ready to go out on your first date, and you've got all the kind of scary and uneasy and exciting feelings about whether that's going to go very well and how you're going to manage that and so on and so forth, as you're just getting ready to go out the door, mother is there saying, "Give us a big kiss." Now, what is any youngster going to say in response to that? "Mother, get out of the way." Now, the reason that must be said and said vehemently is because the child part, in facing that excitement and danger of getting off into the world on your first date, is terrified. And mother's very presence at the door is an all too painful reminder of how that child part yearns to stay at home with mother and have her take you once again on her lap and say, "I'll make cocoa and toast by the fire and we'll tell fairy stories and everything will be all right." Now, you daresn't let that awareness attitude come into awareness. It must be ruthlessly defeated, and the mother who reminds you of it must be scorned. Let me come at it a little bit different way. As little children, we grow up with a kind of attitude about ourselves that protects us from all kinds of worries. And that attitude is, "I am mommy and daddy's good little boy Sammy. Nothing terrible can ever happen to me. Mother is always smiling and happy with me. Daddy is always proud of how good I can play catch. The teachers are always snowed by how neat I can spell. Surely nothing awful is going to happen." Now, it may be that my classmate Charlie gets appendicitis and dies. And you think I'm scared about that? Well, you bet I'm scared about that, but I have a very nifty way of handling that inside my head. It is, "Mommy and Daddy won't let that happen to me." Okay? And you can live with that kind of magical sense of protection that really enables you to get along in the world and to handle all kinds of genuinely scary and frightening things without being paralyzed by them, and to learn to master what you can master and to
you know, move along. Now, when you reach adolescence, somewhere along and you're growing up, you begin to get so sensible that you just can't believe that anymore. And there comes the scary realization that bad things can happen to me even though I am Mommy and Daddy's good little boy, Sammy. And I have to learn to live in a world in which I must take care of myself. And simply being a good guy and simply pleasing my parents is not going to be enough to get through. Now, let me open a rather lengthy footnote. It is possible to head that awareness off forever and to spend one's life in an arrested adolescence in which you are constantly looking around for other parents to somehow magically please and to believe that everything about you is going to be okay because you are being God's good little boy or your Boy Scout leader's good little boy or your wife's good little boy or anybody else's. And what happens is the umbilicus is never cut. You simply unplug it and carry it around in your hot little fist and keep plugging it in every place you can find to give some kind of reassurance that you don't have to take responsibility for running your own risks, making your own boo-boos, picking yourself up, and moving on. Okay? But adolescence is a time where that risk can be looked at, and it is a very scary risk. And the effect for the adolescent is to keep testing the limits of the relationship with his parents and with other adults. Now, the parents get very frightened about this, and I'm going to say more about parents later. But for the kid, it is a matter of learning that you can go beyond the fence, so to speak, of parental approval and survive. Now, a little child, he doesn't test this sort of thing very adventurously. He believes if you really deliberately disobey Mommy and Daddy, God will zap you with lightning. So you'd better not do that. Now, the adolescent has to learn to believe, you know, you can deliberately disobey Mommy and Daddy, and God doesn't zap you with lightning. As a matter of fact, sometimes it feels pretty good. At least you learn that you can manage things okay. And if you cross over the fence, you don't head straight for the woods and fall off the cliff at the end of the woods. You simply run along outside the fence, 6 feet away, in order to get the experience that you can survive in a world without parental protection. And parental protection is viewed as a kind of magic umbrella that will work as long as you're a good guy and do exactly what your parents say. Okay? So you have to get the experience of doing things your parents don't say or not doing things your parents do say or, you know, any variation and combination of those things. Now, sometimes that can get too scary and things will be more than one can comfortably manage. And you have to find a way to get the parents to help you out of a bad situation. For instance, the child part inside oneself can be genuinely worried, much too frightened, about something that the adult self thinks, you know, hey, we'll try that, why not? And will have to act out in such a way as to get the parents to bail him out. The child self. Let me give you an example to be clearer. Son has permission from his father to take the family car. He's got a big evening lined up, and he says, Dad, we're all going to the movies, okay? Okay, says Dad. Now, what Dad does not know is we're not going to the movies at all. A couple of the guys have got a six-pack lined up, and the local high school put-out is going to come along, and we're all going down to the pad and have, you know, gangbusters, right? Except this is the first time we've ever thought of doing something like that. And deep down inside, there are serious reservations. Am I ready to handle all of that? I don't really like the way that feels. I'm not so sure I want to do that. But my goodness, I've made the commitment to the guys, and I don't want to look chicken to them or even to myself. So what's going to happen? Now, I'm talking about a conversation that this young man doesn't really hear inside his head. It goes on without his being aware. He gets up from the dinner table, says, "Dad, I'm going to run the car down through the washerettes before we go, okay?" Sure, fine. He backs the car out of the driveway. He comes in shamefacedly, says, "Dad, you wouldn't believe what happened. I just skinned up the whole side of your car on the telephone pole." Now, what's any father going to say? You know, any reasonably probable, reliable father going to say? "No kid of mine is going to move that car 6 feet tonight. Give me the car keys and go to your room. Furthermore, you're grounded for a week." Now, this guy gets on the phone, he calls his buddies, and he says, "Gee, guys, you wouldn't believe how unreasonable my old man is. I can't go. He's so fussy about a little 6-inch scratch on his beautiful car. Aren't parents materialistic? Isn't that terrible? Sorry, maybe another time." Now, all of this has happened, hopefully without the young person being aware that they were too frightened to deal with this particular piece of growing up at this particular time, and they found an out in reliable parents. That is, the parents are believable as parents. You can count on them to get mad when they ought to get mad. And you have a nice face-saving cover-up, and you don't even have to let yourself know how frightened you are about, you know, dealing with that particular thing. Let me talk a little bit about the parents of adolescents, because our ministry is every bit as much to them. The parents kind of know they too are parties to a war, and that they, as parents, must die. Now, that's why I call it a war between the generations. I don't see any reason why we should pretty that up and say something about bridging it over and everything's going to be hunky-dory. The point is, you're never going to have a child again. It is a loss that is never made up. It's one of the few losses in life that is never made up, and it is extremely painful and difficult for parents to go through. Much of what they have been as people to themselves, much of what has been important to them in identifying themselves, has been in being parents, in being needed. And now they're being ruthlessly rejected as parents, and it hurts. One writer has said, "No mother ever gave birth at adolescence with less pain than at the hour of natural birth." And it is so true. For a second thing, the parents cannot do anything right. Now think of it as a war, and you'll understand that there is no such thing as fraternization with the enemy without there is grave danger going on. The most understanding of parents, who can respond with the most benign suggestions, have to be fought against and resisted simply because there is a war. And I don't care how understanding you are as a parent of an adolescent, you have to be wrong. And you can say it one way today and exactly the opposite way tomorrow, and you'll get precisely the same response from your youngster: "Oh, mother." Because you always have to be wrong. Third, parents have dealt with much of their anxiety and their responsibility about raising kids by controlling the kids. You've all heard that clever one-liner, "A sweater is what you put on when your mother is cold." Now, there is a great deal of that kind of thing always in raising kids. It comes on hard times in adolescence because parents no longer have control. And kids are doing all kinds of scary things out in a very dangerous world, and the parents are left with their anxieties hanging out. You can't make the kid put on a sweater anymore. You're just going to have to sit there and worry. Now, in a little way, it begins the first time we see our youngster go down the driveway on his bicycle all alone for the first time. And it is scary. Any parents are frightened. Their heart's in their throat when they watch this. And parents being parents, they're very realistic. They know that just last week a kid got killed on a bicycle in the next block. Killed. Dead. It has to be scary. How are you going to deal with that anxiety as a parent? Well, one obvious way is, "No kid of mine is ever going to ride a bicycle until he's 21 years old, put it in the garage, and talk to me later." Now, you know, that's a caricature. We know better than to interrupt a youngster's growing up just for the sake of our anxieties. A better response is, dear, mix another batch of martinis and let's go in and watch Johnny Carson. That is, the parents themselves get closer together and much more reassuring of one another. Okay? Now, it can happen with a bicycle when you're, you know, like 4 years old. Think what it is when it's an automobile. There's booze, there's drugs, there's sex involved. All of those really dangerous things that are out there for a youngster to deal with, to make mistakes about, some of which can be fatal. And the anxiety is absolutely enormous. And the temptation to control that anxiety by trying to control the youngster is absolutely irresistible. Gentlemen, we do a great unchristian thing when we sneer and gossip at the parents of the adolescent who has run away from home, is having difficulty in school, has gotten pregnant out of wedlock, and so on and so forth. That is a hurting bit of relationship. A loving tie that has been meaningful for all parties involved is being untied, and it hurts everybody who's involved. And to fail to understand that and to be sympathetic and caring and comforting in very real and understanding ways is to fail as a person in a very miserable way.
The battle between the generations is bound to produce casualties in the family, but hopefully there can be a resurrection of relationships. Yet Stevens warns that this is not always the case.
Obviously and tragically, what goes on with adolescents does not always draw parents together. And that very natural and helpful out is sometimes not available to parents. And they get into a very intense kind of thing where they kind of choose up sides over adolescent behavior, where they have to look at the scary prospect that, you know, 3 more years and this last one is gone and I've got to spend the rest of my life with you. And that is a genuinely scary prospect, and you know, if it cannot be faced and dealt with, there's going to be serious trouble about those last 3 years as this one is trying to get gone. The answer to your question is no, they don't always get closer together. But being aware that that's one of the good ways that things can be worked out with parents, I think puts us on the mark to try and help them to see that and use that that option. What tends to happen if it's not going that way is father gets much busier in his business and mother gets much busier with the bridge club and the PEO or the church. Beware of mothers who are getting busy with the church. And you really have a family that's falling apart over the adolescent crisis that's going on at home.
It would, of course, be ideal if the roles parent and child could be set aside early in the war, a truce declared and the relationships reoriented without the struggle. But Stevens claims that this is impossible.
The image parent is so strong, it's so built into the relationship. I mean, you know, they've been your parents for years, that it virtually obliterates any view of the parent independently and separately as a person in their own right, i.e. adult, at least if I understand the way you're saying it. That will come later if adolescence is successfully transited. Then suddenly you discover that, you know, gee, your old man is an interesting guy to talk to. I mean, you know, he's got lots of great things that are going on in his life that you never imagined. You could sit down for 30 minutes and have a beer with your old man and have it make sense, you see. Well, that's because now finally that parental image is dimmed down and the person of your father can come through. Not to say it isn't there, you know, but it's such a strong bias in favor of parent-child, necessarily, that it's awfully hard to see your parents as people.
There is a sexual dimension to this war, too. Stevens explains two aspects of the parents' sexual involvement in the adolescent's growth.
Sexuality in adolescence is not nearly what parents imagine and fear and fantasy that it is. We adults who've had, you know, a fair share of sexual experience, look at adolescence and we see, you know, lovely girls running around with no bras on and terribly short skirts and guys wearing tight jeans so tight their genitals show, and they go walking off across the field hand in hand, and our mind immediately thinks, zack. Now, the chances are they're not screwing in the woods. That's an adult reading out of our own fantasies and frustrations, let it be added parenthetically, of the way things are. And our feeling, unhappily, is, man, if I was a kid now, knowing what I know now, gangbusters. Now, that usually comes out. That usually comes out in a dishonest form. What's happening to kids these days? Look at that long hair. Look at the way they dress. Isn't it terrible? We didn't do things like that when we were kids. Now that, for the most part, is veiled envy. And most parents of adolescents are 40-ish, over the hill, knowing now, finally, that all their dreams will never be realized. And I don't think I need to elaborate on that. And, you know, struggling to come to grips sensibly with that, and looking at these bright-eyed and bushy-tailed kids in the bloom of life with bitter envy. Okay? It is extremely difficult to get parents to be honest about that. Okay, that's one whole thing. And the notion that you are going to lose that that contact with excitement and stimulation and be stuck with one another for life is indeed facing you with a bitter truth. That is, indeed, you are going to be stuck with one another for life. And there are some very positive things that have to be gained from looking at that and working with that and understanding that. Okay? Now, there's another aspect which, you know, any discerning Freudian is going to comment about, and that is that there is a special attraction between a child and the parent of the opposite sex. And it is essential that the youngster finally renounce that attraction and move on to somebody else. Sometimes that's difficult because that attraction has a very special meaning to, in fact, the parent of the opposite sex. And to lose your darling daughter to the grubby hands of some long-haired greaser whose evil designs you know only too well can be so painful and so difficult to really admit to yourself that you spend a lot of time and energy stewing, fretting, reading Playboy magazine, being angry with your wife, haranguing church board meetings with our Sunday school classes aren't doing enough. Most of which is a dodge for how difficult it is to lose someone that you have loved and who, as a matter of fact, is very sexy and very delightful to have around, and that's relationships being broken. Okay? I speak of it as from the father's point of view because I'm a father. One could equally speak of it from the mother's point of view.
Where does the church and its pastors fit into the war between the generations? Ed Stevens comments first upon the church's role in the life of the adolescent, and then the pastor's involvement.
The church for an adolescent is primarily seen as the parent's bag, you know, if not the establishment, which is even worse. And it's very difficult to break in on that in a meaningful way. Now, to a certain extent, if it can be free of too much parental kind of stuff, kids, the natural idealism of adolescence can really catch them up in it pretty good. But you have to be a little careful about that, and you have to be willing to let kids not be all that involved in church during adolescence. Now, that's the hardest thing in the world for us to tolerate, because we think we've really lost them to the Lord. we've lost the child to the Lord, we can recover an adult to the Lord if we don't monkey in the process by being parentified lords to them. There must be some way to soften that and state it much more eloquently, but I don't know what it is. There's another aspect to it. If all of you should surely have read John Updike's Rabbit Run, in which there are characterizations of two clergymen. One is, unhappily, a Lutheran, a very rigid, uptight, old-fashioned guy, and Rabbit, this kind of delayed adolescent, goes to him for counsel when his marriage is falling apart. He doesn't get much but piety there. The other is, unhappily, an Episcopalian, who's a very young, hip, psychologically shrewd guy who plays golf with Rabbit, and tries to help him work through his psychological problems. And Rabbit, really, between these two guys, ends up in the same position as Job. Miserable comforters are you all. The failing here is a little hard to describe. It is most discouraging to adolescents to look to adults only to discover that adults either, number one, are miserable at being adults themselves, or number two, are aping youth in order to somehow believe that youth has all the pleasures and adulthood has all the misery and the responsibility. And the absence of genuine adult joy and pleasure in life is most disheartening to adolescents as they look towards the prospect of growing up. And somehow, ministers and all types who can be public figures with which, to which young people can look for identification as they struggle to grow up and take courage from the fact that you can really be pretty neat as an adult, with authenticity as an adult, that's a great thing.
The gospel has its place at the heart and the core of our ministry to youth. Stevens explains this New Testament dimension in terms of freedom and legalism.
We have a whole New Testament gospel that tells us to stop with the comfort of legalism is to stop short of the joy that God intends and the life more abundant. And one of the hang-ups of adolescence that's very typical is to stop short with legalism. And the idealism that I spoke about that's so common a feature in adolescence is something that the church often capitalizes on simply because it's so easy to lock adolescents into legalism. There's an element of being a churchman and leading as a churchman that ought to say courageously, I take the risks right along with you. I want you to be as free in this community of relationship as we are called to be by the New Testament. And I'm not going to lock you into a legalistic bag any more than I want myself to be locked into a legalistic bag. Now, believe me, that can be lived out with style and grace in any congregation.